I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. What is it about that top-secret Coca-Cola formula that makes it so delicious some people just can't stop drinking it? How is it that no matter how many Lay's potato chips they eat, some people never get quite enough? New York Times investigative reporter Michael Moss finds that food scientists at companies like Coca-Cola, Kraft, and Frito-Lay employ a special chemistry of salt, sugar, and fat to keep customers demanding more of their products. As a result, the processed food industry has become complicit in the U.S. obesity epidemic, now affecting 1 in 3 adults and 1 in 5 children. Salt, sugar, fat. How the food giants hooked us. On Midday after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. Every year, the average American eats 33 pounds of cheese and 70 pounds of sugar. Almost none of the salt we eat in a day comes out of our own salt shakers. Instead, we're getting it from the processed foods that now make up to 70% of the American diet. The obesity epidemic has exploded into a public health crisis, now affecting 1 in 3 adults and 1 in 5 children, at a health care cost estimated to be $300 billion per year. Despite growth in the availability of organic produce, the popularity of farmers' markets, sales of convenience foods have never been higher, and familiar companies like Kraft, General Mills, Nestle, and Pepsi Cola are seeing $1 trillion in sales annually. In his new book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Michael Moss takes us inside the labs where food engineers manipulate the three pillars of manufactured food, the Holy Trinity, so to speak, salt, sugar, and fat, into addictive food that some people literally cannot stop eating. Conversations with industry insiders reveal that the industry itself has come to rely heavily on these three ingredients to just make their products, and grocery stores are flooded with up to 60,000 of their finest efforts. Added salt, sugar, and fat make Cheez-Its crunchy and yellow. They keep ham from getting so rubbery that it can bounce right off the floor. They're also responsible for the mysterious bliss point, which we'll be discussing in this hour of the show. The bliss point, identified by researchers as the point at which Dr. Pepper tastes so good, you just want to keep chugging. Michael Moss is a reporter for the New York Times and an adjunct professor at the Columbia School of Journalism. He won the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting on the meat industry and pink slime. Michael Moss, welcome to Midday on WYPR Baltimore.
Thanks so much for having me, Dan. And I have to say quickly, it's a special treat for me because my wife is from Baltimore. We'll be down there this weekend.
Oh, great.
Visiting her lovely parents, Leah and Herman Hein. Herman, by the way, is the famous street corner astronomer.
You're kidding. Your father-in-law is Herman Hein?
There you go. My two boys are so excited already. They cannot get enough of looking through his telescope. So I'm hoping for clear weather.
How do you like that? He's one of the most interesting men I know in Baltimore. And this is his time of year. This is when the skies are full of all kinds of things to see.
He's also a stickler for science. So really, I'm just softening him up in case I make a flub on your show today.
Well, it's nice to have that connection. Thank you for mentioning it, Michael Moss.
Not at all.
Do you mind if we just start at the bliss point? I think that's a good place to start here. Mr. Moskowitz and the bliss point. Why don't we start there?
Howard Moskowitz, trained at Harvard in experimental psychology, is a legend in the food industry. He helped create many of the icons in the grocery store, and he walked me through his recent creation of a new soda flavor for Dr. Pepper. And I have to say, like so much of the book, this was like being inside a detective story for me. To achieve what you described as the bliss point, which he helped coin back in the 60s, the term, he took 61 different variations of sweet flavor for this new flavoring he was trying to develop, each just slightly different than the other, and submitted them to more than 3,000 consumer taste tests around the country, took all the data, threw it into his computer, did his fancy high math regression analysis, looked at the data, and came up with the very perfect formula. He calls this engineering, by the way, that was guaranteed to make the flavor a hit. And when we sat down and looked at the data, he explained to me that our liking for sugar isn't infinite. Your listeners can do the experiment themselves if they like sugar in their coffee. Just keep adding sugar until you get to the optimum level where you like it the most. Keep adding more until you get eventually to the yuck point. Well, that data will look like an inverted U-shaped, an upside-down bell-shaped curve, where at the top will be the bliss point, as Howard Moskowitz helped coin it. The very perfect amount, no more, no less sweetness that will send us over the moon.
A note here from your book, developing soldiers' rations for the Army in the 1970s, he discovered that people liked flavorful foods but would stop eating them more quickly. White bread, on the other hand, could be eaten lots and lots, and you wouldn't feel like you'd had enough.
You know, another great term, and look, investigative reporters are always taught to follow the money, and there was, as you mentioned, you know, $1 trillion in annual sales to follow in the course of this reporting for the book, but I also just totally fell in love with the terminology that the food scientists and marketing people come up with, because it's so revealing about what they're doing. And in this case, the term is sensory-specific satiety. Howard, in doing work for the Army, where the challenge was getting soldiers to eat more, not less, especially when they were out in the field, you know, discovered that there's this quirk in our palates, which basically goes, we'll really love something that has a strong flavor to it. He used chicken or turkey tetrazzini as an example, but we'll tire of it really quickly, as opposed to a more bland but, you know, but still palatable item like white bread, which we can keep eating ad infinitum. And the food industry has learned to factor in this thing called sensory-specific satiety in creating some of its best-selling products. Tasty, but not so tasty. Our brains will go, whoa, had enough of that today, Michael.
So in terms of sweetness, when we're talking about sugar, say, for instance, and the bliss point is the point where you shouldn't sweeten past, right?
You should
sweeten just short of the bliss point.
Yes, absolutely. We're right at the bliss point, so not too little sugar, not too much. It's hitting the precise amount that will hit the taste buds, send those signals to the brain's pleasure center. That's what we're talking about here, which will then send signals back to you saying, eat more of this. This is absolutely perfect.
Michael Moss, when you spoke to Howard Moskowitz about this, and all of these folks that you spoke with, except for those who are no longer in the business, it sounds like you were dealing in trade secrets here. I'm surprised that some of them were so candid with you about the science of this.
I was lucky enough to come across a trove of confidential documents that put me and ultimately the readers of the book at the table of these food giants when they are planning, plotting, and formulating their way to success. And one of the things to remember here is that the driving force in this industry is not how do we make our products, how do we make people like our products? It's how do we get people to eat more and more of our products? And with those documents at hand, they enabled me to help convince some of the top officials in the scientific circles at these companies and marketing sectors to reveal even more secrets. And it was fascinating.
I got to say, it is fascinating. Michael, I got to say that when you say the term to me, food additives, being a baby boomer, I think in terms of preservatives. I think of, you know, what is the industry adding to processed foods to make it last longer, to give it a longer shelf life? But no, that's not what it's about. It's about selling more. I'm holding up a bag of nacho cheese Doritos here today and a bottle of good old-fashioned Coca-Cola. The idea is to get people to buy more and more of these.
No, absolutely. And it's so telling how important salt, sugar, fat are to the food industry. And I can't say that enough. And this is the holy grail This is the holy trinity of ingredients to them. And they know through their own research and experience that when they use lots of these three in the perfect amounts, their products will be guaranteed to fly off the shelves, we'll buy more, we'll eat more. And they, being companies, will do what companies do, which is make more money.
Michael Moss, I want to quote here from a section about Howard Moskowitz. When you met him in Midtown Manhattan at the Harvard Club about 3 years ago, you said, as we talked, he made clear that while he has worked on numerous projects aimed at creating more healthful foods and insist the industry could be doing far more to curb obesity, Mr. Moskowitz had no qualms about his own pioneering work on discovering what industry insiders now regularly refer to as the bliss point, or any of the other systems that help food companies create the greatest amount of crave. Quote, "There's no moral issue for me," he said. "I did the best science I could. I was struggling to survive and didn't have the luxury of being a moral creature. As a researcher, I was ahead of my time." What about some of the others that you spoke with, including one significant whistleblower that we'll talk about? What do they say these days about the moral question in all of this?
You know, many of these people, including Dr. Moskowitz, are pure scientists. I mean, when they're inside the job, they're doing their utmost best to make the customer happy, in this case, the food company that's hired them. I mean, I think Howard has come to have some regret in the sense that he really wishes that the industry had and will now pay more attention to doing the kinds of things that he thinks could create products that are both tasty and truly healthy. A number of the inventors of Icons that I met have also come to have some regret because the playing field has changed over the years. From the days when they invented these products back in the 70s and 80s, some of them, it was different back then. Our own dependence on them was less than it was today. And something remarkable happened in the 80s when it became acceptable almost overnight to eat anything, anywhere, anytime. You suddenly saw people walking down the street drinking and eating and bringing food into business meetings where you never saw that before. And that played right into the hands of the processed food industry and especially the snack food industry because it led to what scientists call sort of mindless eating where you're going hand to mouth. The brain is sort of getting cut out of the equation. You're not thinking about the food and that easily leads to overeating.
Michael Moss joining us in this hour of Midday on WYPR. His book published by Random House, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Already a comment by email. I am still reading this book and it already changed the way I look at food and the way I eat. Cutting sugar and paying close attention to fat content is helping me lose weight successfully. It also explained to me why I and so many of my friends are suddenly struggling with weight gain after moving to the U.S. from Poland, where processed food was absent from our tables. That's signed D from Pasadena, Maryland. You can join us at 410-662-8780 or send an email as D did, midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodrigues here. Our guest this hour is Michael Moss of the New York Times. His book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. One last note about Mr. Moskowitz, Howard Moskowitz. He was a pioneer when it came to jarred spaghetti sauce. And I note from your book, sugar is the second ingredient after tomatoes in ragu and those other jarred. I don't know if it's true of all of them.
In many of the commercial sauces, yes.
Yeah. And one last thing I want to ask you about on terminology. When we say processed food, just take a minute on this, would you please, Michael? I think you know it when you see it, but when we're using that figure, you know, 70% of the American diet processed food, that covers, what does it cover?
It's basically covering most of the grocery store, except for, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables, although one could argue that baby carrots are also processed and that they're whittled down from the thing that's pulled out of the ground, mm-hmm. actually. But we're talking about here sort of ultra-processed foods is another word that nutritionists use, things that have been heavily converted from their original whole state into a product that's convenient, long-lasting on the shelf, really low cost, utterly tasty, and heavily reliant, as I found out, on salt, sugar, and fat.
Did all this start with breakfast cereals, adding sugar?
It sort of did. You can go back to the turn of the century and Dr. Kellogg and his creation of cereal. He hated sugar, and he had a sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan, where guests came to get healthy. He wouldn't let them touch sugar. Created a sugarless cereal for them that was, well, probably not the tastiest thing in the world. And they had a bit of a family feud. His younger brother, Will, came along and was put in charge of the cereal. And one day when the doctor wasn't looking, Will added sugar. The people loved it. Sales soared. The two brothers fought. And in the end, the Kellogg Company arose from the legal battle to become, you know, one of the most successful pioneers of pre-sweetened cereal.
I was interested in this period you covered in the 1950s and 60s, sugar frosted flakes, the advent of Tang, instant breakfast drinks, the Pop-Tart in 1963, and also during that time, the emergence, maybe a little earlier, of Betty Crocker.
Yes.
And the idea that, hey, you know, we need to be doing more cooking at home, those things seem to be in conflict, right?
This is a really critical moment. On one hand, you had home economics in schools, which used to teach both girls and boys about shopping, cooking, nutrition. And as it was slowly dying off, as other sort of competitive interests came into the classroom, there was this growth of home economics as the processed food industry saw it. And Betty Crocker became the epitome of, or rather the queen of home economics, aimed at getting people to buy more convenience foods in shopping in the grocery store. And General Foods, the old food giant that later merged with Kraft, was the place where actually the term convenience foods was coined by the CEO, who was a marketing specialist, had come up through the ranks of the company. And it was through his drive and vision that the things you mentioned, like Tang, were created to make food ever more, seemingly anyway, ever more convenient for us busy Americans, especially as we get busier in our lives.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here. If you'd like to join our conversation with Michael Moss about his book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Let's take a quick call here for Michael, and then we'll go back to my questions. Trip in Dundalk, you're on the show. Go right ahead, please.
Yes, thanks for the continuing education here. I consider all these things that were being fed kind of like an accumulative poison. But specifically with Domino's, I know a few years ago their taste acceptability was atrocious.
You're talking about Domino's pizza?
Yes, they took it off the market and it came back and it was pretty tasty stuff. And I had this mental picture of a room full of pizza chefs getting together and saying, what's wrong with us? But are you saying that it was a room full of taste specialists that reworked Domino's?
Well, sure, whether you're in the fast food industry or the grocery manufacturing business, taste is everything, along with convenience and low price, I should say, and they will say some adherence to nutrition. But, you know, they cannot sell. I mean, to their defense, again, and I should make this point that I don't view the processed food industry as an evil empire that intended to get us obese and otherwise ill. And they could also rightfully say that, look, you can't point to any one of our products for being responsible for the obesity epidemic, whether it's soda or my favorite potato chips. But they will draw the line at taste and say that we cannot sell products that are not utterly tasty. And so, again, every ounce of their effort, of their formula people, their scientists, their marketing people, is aimed at perfecting the taste. Again, not to get you to like their product, but to get you to want more and more and come back for more.
Interesting quote here from Jeffrey Dunn in your book. Now, he's the former top guy at Coca-Cola, right?
For North America and Latin America, he was the president, right. Yes. He spent 20 years at Coca-Cola.
Well, I was interested in this quote. You start to get into the question of what drives what. Does the preference for soda and snacks drive the availability of soda and snacks? Or does availability drive the preference? None of the players stopped to think about whether people should really be eating a bag of chicken wings and a bag of potato chips and a 2-liter Coke. But that first part of that is really, does the preference for soda and snacks drive the availability, or does the availability drive the preference?
It's really fascinating. I think at the time, too, we were talking about the snack food industry's targeting, especially of inner city kids through convenience stores, where you walk in and the layout is almost uniform from store to store. There are the big soda bottles, followed by the sweet snack cakes, followed by the salty chips. And then if the kid has any money left over, there's the penny candy at the checkout register. And Jeff Dunn was explaining to me the dynamics of what is called in the industry up and down the street marketing, where the trucks owned by the food manufacturers visit the stores, go in with their supply, make sure it's all positioned and laid out properly. And he was sort of speaking to this phenomenon. People like to talk about food deserts in cities, especially where people don't have good access to big supermarkets with fresh produce or easy access. But I like to think of it more as food swamps, because kids especially are going into these stores, and for a dollar or dollar and a few cents, they're coming out with 350 empty calories, and they're often doing this on the way to school in the morning. That's driving their teachers crazy.
Well, the latter part of that quote from Dunn, none of the players stopped to think about the consequences, really, or whether people should be eating this kind of food. That goes also to another question. What we're talking about, an industry here that really does not think of the health of the consumer, number one. That is not what they're preoccupied with. They're preoccupied with Wall Street and pleasing Wall Street, no?
Yep. No, Jeffrey Dunn was one of the fiercest warriors at Coca-Cola for 20 years, and he walked me through, again, the company's targeting of teens, the pioneering of the super size me phenomena, the warlike terminology used inside Coca-Cola and Pepsi as well, where they refer to their best customers as heavy users, people who will drink as much as 3 cans or more of Coke a day, 1,000 a year. And Jeffrey explained to me that, look, I mean, he doesn't, well, I should say that at one point he broke from the company. He was traveling in Brazil with some of his senior executives. They were showing him how they were introducing smaller, less expensive Cokes to the emerging middle class there. And he almost had an epiphany, almost a voice from the sky saying, these people need a lot of things in life, but it's not another Coca-Cola. And he came back to Atlanta and started pressing the company to do some healthier things like promote water and cut back on marketing to schools. It didn't work out as much as Jeffrey wanted. He left. I caught up with him recently where he's now selling fresh baby carrots using a page from the playbook of this snack food industry, which I think is just utterly brilliant. But he says that, look, even in talking to his friends at Coke now, he doesn't view them as being evil-minded. It's just that when they're in the throes of the battle, in that case, their battle with the arch-villains at Pepsi, they're just into the game. They're into the fight, and they're not able to step back and think about the broader context, in this case, the obesity crisis, until they leave. And so many people I've met have left their companies and come up to me and say, look, Michael, when I was inside, I just didn't see it.
Of course, they don't eat their own products.
In many cases, not. That was another surprising thing, Dan, of how many senior executives at these companies I met who do not eat their company's own products. They know better, and especially when they run into health problems. A senior scientist at Kraft explained to me that he used to jog for exercise, and he blew out his knee and couldn't do that anymore to burn off calories. The first thing he did was to cut calories in every liquid that he drank, because he knew there's some recent science that shows that our brains may be less apt to detect calories in liquids. And so he wanted to stick to calories in solid food. But the other thing he stopped doing was eating potato chips. He was one of those people who would get home in the evening, open a big bag, know that he should stick to a few chips or one small serving, and he'd eat the whole thing. So for him, the grocery store became a bit of a minefield where he had to duck and dodge, again, including some of his own company's product.
Michael Moss is our guest in this hour of Midday. His book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, that's published by Random House. So I'm holding a bag of Doritos in my hand, as I said earlier, Michael. This is a 3 3/8 ounce bag with sodium, 210 milligrams of sodium. We spoke earlier about sugar and its role in the bliss point. Now I'm curious about salt and the bliss point, and also about Doritos, the issue of mouthfeel, all part of this the science of processed food. So would you talk about salt and then a little bit on this the principle of mouthfeel?
So salt is perhaps the most miraculous of these three ingredients for the food industry because it does so much more than taste. I mean, with the Doritos, yes, you're getting what the industry calls the flavor burst, the salts on the outside of the chip. It's the first thing that hits your taste buds to get dissolved by the saliva, which sends the signals again to the brain's pleasure center, which says, more, this is going to make me healthy. So yes, it has that function, but salt has so much more function for the processed food industry. It allows them to avoid using more costly ingredients like fresh herbs and spices. It acts as a preservative, allowing their products to sit on the shelf for weeks or months at a time. It also covers up some of the off flavors, the bad taste that are inherent to some ultra-processed foods. One of the most telling moments I had in the reporting for the book was when Kellogg invited me into their research and development laboratory in Battle Creek. We toured, we tasted, and then we sat down and we tasted some of their most iconic products that they had made specially for me without any salt at all, because they wanted to impress upon me the difficulty they were having under public and government pressure to cut back on their usage of salt. And I have to tell you, Dan, it was one of the most god-awful experiences I ever had.
So, you mentioned, what kind of cereal?
So, well, we started with the Cheez-Its, which mentioned. Mm-hmm. Normally, I could eat day in and day out. And without the salt, we couldn't even swallow them. They stuck to the roof of their mouth because the salt provides texture and solubility. We moved on to the frozen waffles, popped them in the toaster. They came out looking and tasting like straw. And yes, then we moved to the cereal, put it in the bowl, added some milk, started tasting. With me was the company's spokeswoman and their top scientist. And before I could say anything, she got, the spokeswoman, a look of horror on her face, swallowed and blurted out, "Metal. I taste metal, M-E-T-A-L, and the scientist kind of chuckled and said, "Yeah, not everybody will taste that, but many people do. You know, that's the result of some of the other additives to our products, as many other products happen, and you'll get this metal taste that salt will help mask." One of my favorite masking attributes of salt is to cover up something called warmed over flavor in meat. When meat gets reheated by the consumer in a processed food, it will often emit what's called warmed over flavor. The fat oxidizes. Food scientists describe the taste as wet dog hair. And salt will act as a masking agent for that as well.
And when we get to mouthfeel with Doritos,
yes,
this is also part of the process of putting a product,
yes,
out, right?
So you're getting, so the Dorito, you're getting that initial hit of salt called the flavor burst, and then you're getting the taste of the fat in the Dorito. But this isn't a real taste because fat is not one of our five basic taste senses, as Aristotle defined them way back when. In fact, it's a feeling. A nerve ending comes into almost to the top of the roof of your mouth and picks up that sensation. So fat is the warm, gooey sensation of biting into a toasted cheese sandwich, and the industry calls it the mouthfeel. And in some ways, it's even more powerful than sugar. Fat has twice the calories as sugar, but it has a way of sneaking up on the brain in ways that doesn't avoids triggering the natural brakes that the brain tries to put on us to avoid overheating. So, for example, studies have been done when you can see fat in the food that you're eating, like oil on top of soup, you'll eat less than you will if the fat is blended into the soup. You have ways of picking up on that, which is just totally amazing and totally powerful to the food industry.
And you mentioned a company, I can't remember where this is, it's in Europe, I think, that found a way of putting fat droplets into ice cream.
Yeah, well, the companies are all sort of working at ways to manipulate kind of the physical shape of salt, sugar, and fat. And, you know, many of these efforts actually could turn out to be, you know, of benefit to consumer health and nutrition. With fat, for example, they're trying to, and this is Nestle, they're trying to figure out ways to adjust the size of the fat globules so you'll get a bigger hit of mouthfeel for less saturated fat, which is the fat that's typically linked to heart disease. Salt, on the other hand, comes in as many as 40 different varieties if you include all the additives and the packaging. Everything from a very finely powdered salt that's useful to dissolve in canned soup, which I'm sure many of your listeners will agree is can be incredibly salty, to big chunky pyramid-shaped salt that dissolves faster and hits your brain more quickly with that flavor burst allure.
Mm. Hey, one last thing on this bag of Doritos that I have in my hands. There's an advertisement on the back of the bag for Doritos Jacked. Doritos Jacked. Bigger, bolder, thicker. For more bold experiences, snack boldly on Doritos Jacked. So what could that mean? Could that mean that the people who've been eating Doritos have reached a point where they just need to be jacked? They need more? More salt? They need more...
You know,
what?
I'm so glad that's a new one to me, Dan. But that's what, you know, it's so, you know, you gotta love the industry just for being so forthright with their advertising.
Yeah.
Go back to one of the original chip advertisements that Madison Avenue came up with for Frito-Lay. Bet you can't eat just one.
Yeah, perfect,
it almost just dares us to challenge the obvious. And, you know, I like to tell people now that, I mean, hopefully they'll see my book as an empowerment walking into the grocery store. And we all know to look at the fine print on labels, but I like to actually say, and I like to start, you know, myself now by looking at the front of the label, or in this case, the back with the big print, because that's where the touting is and the come-ons and putting the best foot forward by the companies. It's often revealing in and of itself.
Michael Moss, our guest in this hour of Midday. You're welcome to call in with a comment or question about his work on the processed food industry in his book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Our phone number for Midday is 410-662-8780. Our toll-free long-distance number, 866-661-9309. Send us an email to midday@wypr.org. You can also go to the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, where we've posted a link to the excerpt of Michael Moss's book that appeared in the New York Times Magazine. We'll be right back. Hey, Michael Moss, some years ago in Baltimore, I attended a cereal chemists convention. Cereal, C-E-R-E-A-L. and I met the man who invented Cap'n Crunch. And
wow.
I thought that was kind of cool, but I never thought of asking these questions. How do you feel now that you were responsible for most of my cavities in my youth? I didn't ask those questions. Hey, this ought to make you feel good, Michael. This is an email from Nancy. Nancy, who is a teacher, I think. I'm sorry. She's the upper school librarian at this Key School in Annapolis. She says that Mr. Moss's article in the New York Times Magazine, which is an excerpt from the book, is required reading in my ninth grade life skills class at the Key School. My students are using iMovie to create public service announcements for real food or spoof ads for so-called junk food. Thanks for your good work.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you for that, Nancy. I'd love to see some of those videos. Write to me at the New York Times, if you will.
Karen in Cockeysville joining us now with Michael Moss. Hi, Karen. Go right ahead, please.
Hi. How are you? Actually, this is Karen in Pikesville.
Oh, Pikesville. Okay.
Yeah. And it's ironic because I'm making matzo balls for tonight's Seder, which are loaded with fat and salt. But the idea is I'm very blessed. I'm almost 57, and I'm a nurse, and I still work. And what I tell people to do, because they're always asking me, oh, you look so thin, and you're so this, you're so that, it's all about eating real food most of the time, eating mostly well most of the time, and trying to avoid the processed food as much as possible. And I actually have an experience where I'm part of our synagogue's reception. They make these kiddushes reception after the services. And it's very sad to me because I feel like a pusher because, of course, they make everything the way people want to eat, which is salty, fatty, blah, blah, blah. And I'm laying it out there, and then I'm standing back and watching. And, you know, people are talking as they're eating, and they're shoveling the food in. And I know that they're not really tasting it. You taste the first bite, and then they're so intent on what. And I'm not looking down on them. I'm not disdainful of them. But I just feel sad, you know, because there's a lot of obesity. And as a nurse, I feel terrible. It's like I almost felt like quitting the committee, except that it's a nice little volunteer thing to do for my synagogue. So I guess, you know, I try to, I never say anything to anybody unless they ask me. And then I'll tell them how I live my life. And I try to be an example to people. But what are the other things that we can do to move all this forward, to get people back to eating real food? Like, it's okay to have
Yeah, thank you, Karen. Thank you very much, and good Seder to you. Michael?
Yeah, that reminds you, too, of my own mother used to say to me as a kid was, Michael, chew your food. And I think that she was, besides trying to get me not to choke on the roast beef, was, you know, speaking to this issue of more mindful eating and knowing that the brain takes some time to catch up with your mouth and signal you not to overeat. And I'm so glad the caller made the point, too, of our, you know, our own special meals being loaded with salt, sugar, and fat. I mean, look, that defines the diet in my household on, you know, any number of nights. We have two young boys. There's no way that we're going to avoid processed foods in our lives because my wife Eve works outside of the home too. You know, our goal is to gain control over them rather than let them gain control over us. And so a simple thing we've done with cereal, for example, Eve gave the boys a 5 gram per serving sugar maximum. And so now when we go into the grocery store with them, you know, it becomes of a bit of a hunt for them, and they'll pick up the box and they'll look on the label and they will look for those cereals that have 5 grams or less. And they're there, plain Cheerios, total. I think I saw them eating Special K the other day. Now, I may have to, you know, reach high or they may have to reach low to find them because the most sugary cereals are strategically located at eye level, like so much of the most loaded processed foods. But they are there if you hunt for them. So there's certainly some things you can do immediately as consumers. The other thing is just to be louder. These companies are under enormous pressure from Wall Street to perform for their shareholders, which means to maximize their profits. And unless they hear from consumers more loudly, they're not going to make meaningful changes. And maybe this book, by reading it and giving it to friends and having them buy it, maybe that will help, you know, create more of a public discussion around these issues.
Another phone call for our guest, Michael Moss. This is Chris in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday.
Hi. Yeah. Fascinating topic. I actually heard you a week or so ago on another program talking about this, Michael. I'm glad to get to hear some more of it that wasn't talked about there. But I've actually had to make dietary changes because of health. Predominantly, I've had to cut out salt. And I've gotten to a point where I don't crave those processed foods really anymore. And if I do happen to take care or eat something like that, even if you can't taste that saltiness in it, within 5 to 10 minutes of that first bite, I can actually tell how much sodium is in it because my lips will immediately start to dry out. And I think we've gotten to a point in our society where, at best, people are indifferent about being addicted to these foods, and at worst, just don't even care or realize it.
That's really so interesting because when I get to the salt section of my book, I was really struck by how yes, we're hooked on these three ingredients. The industry has helped shape our liking and attraction to them. But the industry itself is even more intractably hooked. And it's so evident with salt. It turns out we're not even born liking salt. It doesn't happen until about 6 months of age. And recent studies have shown that the processed food industry is hugely influential on shaping our liking for salt. Kids that are exposed most to processed foods are much more apt to be licking the salt shaker by the time they're in preschool. And as your listener pointed out, it's not that hard to get off of salt. Anybody on a low-sodium diet under doctor's orders knows that after maybe 6 weeks, it's actually really hard to eat many of the foods in the grocery store. That said, as I pointed out with Kellogg, you know, it's much harder for the industry itself to get unhooked.
Michael, after doing all this work in the last few years and the book, would you say that our own U.S. Department of Agriculture is complicit in the obesity epidemic?
I was really struck by that. And you can sort of look at the numbers. The Department of Agriculture has this massive headquarters on the mall not far from the monument. But to find it spends tens and tens of millions of dollars on part of its mission, which is to help agriculture and the food industry. And then the part of the department whose mission it is to try to encourage us to eat better and help us eat better isn't in Washington at all. It's in a little satellite office in Virginia where you have to take the metro and then a bus and then walk and then the elevator up. Their entire annual budget is $6.5 million. That dichotomy is sort of one of the issues here and the inherent conflict of interest within the Department of Agriculture. And one of the, we don't have much time for this, but one of the most telling examples of this is the way that the Department of Agriculture has pushed the increased consumption of cheese and meat, which tend to be the more the products with the most saturated fat, at the same time that its tiny little consumer arm has been encouraging people to moderate its consumption of those two ingredients.
I'll throw this in and then we'll go to another phone call. An estimated 32 million Americans are taking drugs to reduce their cholesterol levels. 24 million have type 2 diabetes. 79 million have prediabetes. 3,600 children are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes every year. Back to the phone lines. Tony is in Colombia. You're on with Michael Moss. Hi.
Yes, I have a question. When I grew up in the 60s and 70s, my family was from Latin America, and my mother, you know, she was a homemaker. She cooked a lot of the meals, and so we were getting probably less processed foods than the typical American household. And, you know, one time there were some Fritos around, and I remember eating them and, you know, eating a whole bag or whatever, and then really, really feeling awful afterwards. And never again, you know, my entire life did I ever enjoy Fritos. And I just wonder if, you know, these tastes, you know, there's an important component where it has to be developed. It's not just entirely natural to like this, you know, high sugar and salt content.
I think you may be right, Tony. I've heard this from a number of people, especially Europeans come here, even Canadians. I was in Toronto the other day, and they were saying how sweet American food tastes to them. That, yes, I think that there is, again, going to the processed food industry, a huge influence in developing our palates. And a scientist at the Monell Center in Philadelphia said to me, look, one of the issues here and one of the problems here is how the processed food industry has made so many foods in the supermarket sweet, bread, tomato sauce, that didn't used to be sweet before. They're teaching kids, and in her words, they were exploiting the biology of the child, because kids especially are hardwired for sugar because it provides instant calories. They're teaching kids to expect sweetness in foods that didn't used to be sweet. And so the cumulative effect, you know, now is reflected in our average consumption of 70 pounds of sugar a year. Again, salt, sugar, and fat are not inherently bad for anybody. It's the huge amounts that we are encouraged to eat when our diets are dominated and controlled by these ultra-processed foods.
Bob in Baltimore, you're up next with Michael Moss. Go right ahead with your question, please, Bob.
Can you comment about the use of aspartame, the ingredient in things like diet soda, and the negative possible health consequences? Thank you.
I ducked that one, unfortunately, except for there are a couple of really important things to think about, though, which is that the testing of the sugar substitutes has not been extensive enough, according to scientists that I've come to trust, especially when they combine multiple sweetener replacements in the same product. The other thing is that I've heard from so many people that, you know, drinking diet soda just doesn't work as a weight loss thing. And I think what happens is that people almost get the sense that they're getting a prophylactic against calories when they have a diet soda. And then they feel sort of self-confident and begin and are more apt to eat a couple more cookies or that muffin afterward, subconsciously thinking that they're protected and shielded against those extra calories. So if you don't drink, you know, if you don't alter your entire diet while drinking diet soda, you're not going to have the sort of weight control gains that you might be thinking of. I've also talked to people who drink, you know, 10 diet sodas a day and they stop. And they feel so much healthier.
The people who run this industry like that at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the question is, what's for dinner? And a lot of Americans don't have a clue. A question about the processed food and helping out with the household. Are processed foods actually cheaper than fresh foods, Michael? Were you able to determine that? Because that's the reputation that processed foods have.
You know, it's kind of case by case. And look, sometimes we come home, there is basically nothing to do in time but to pop a frozen pizza in the oven for the boys, and Eve and I will make something else for us. So look, there are occasions when we are still dependent on processed foods, and we try to buy a frozen pizza that has a healthier nutrition profile. But one of the, one of the sort of amazing things about processed foods and convenience is that many of the products in the grocery store really aren't all that convenient. I've stopped buying a lot of prepared pasta sauces because they are so sweet, and discovered that you can make your own tomato sauce, like my mom did, by taking a little garlic, olive oil, whatever spices are handy, then a can or box of plain tomatoes, which are not salted or sweetened. Then you have control over how much salt and sugar to add, and I found that just a pinch of each will really bring out the flavors. You're doing your own flavor burst thing that you have control over. And you can do that in 5 minutes while you're talking to your kids and making food kind of part of the evening thing. So the convenience thing, I think, is actually overhyped by the industry. And we all have come to, you know, been made to believe that we have to have convenience foods in order to live a busy life. And I think what's really interesting moving forward are finding ways that, in fact, you can make your own foods, more wholesome foods, buy, you know, on your own and not lose that much time.
A couple more comments, Michael. Carol on Facebook. Okay, I'm convinced. No more cheese doodles, Chex Mix, or chicken wings instead of lunch. Sweets are not the problem. It's the salt and crunch that are addicting. And Katina says, our family has been convenience food free for 2 years now. And this year we've signed up for a community-supported agriculture farm, a CSA. I believe that our society has lost the taste of real food because of all the added salt and sugar. We need to get back to the real taste of food. Taking a note from Michael Pollan on that one. Michael Moss has been our guest. We highly recommend his book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Michael, we certainly appreciate having you on the show today, and I guess you'll be headed for Baltimore soon.
I will, yeah. Hoping for good weather.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And continue good work. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to our first hour of Midday today, our interview there with Michael Moss. As I said earlier, there's an excerpt of his book in the New York Times Magazine. I put a link to that story on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. The book is published by Random House. We're going to take a break here for lunch brought to us today. Oh, talk about fresh food. Brought to us today by Atwaters, supporting local radio, local farmers, and local appetites. Local food located locally at Belvedere Square, the shops at Kenilworth, Bear Hills, and also Main Street, Catonsville. Visit atwaters.biz for more information about their fare. All right, we take a break here for lunch. The news from NPR, and then the second hour of Midday, we're going to be talking about guns. Several issues to update you on, so please stay tuned for that.